international finance, markets, crisis and law. We can understand the structure and operation and recent changes and events that have occurred in international finance through these basic set of presentation slides. What we're essentially looking at this is international markets, money and debt, and we can understand this in terms of it was two separate worlds. There was a global financial economy and then an underlying global mercantile or trade-based economy. That was the old world buying and selling goods. On top of that, over the last 100, 200 years, we've built a larger global financial economy. These actually operate separately. They work together. They help each other. You cannot have the global mercantile economy without the financial economy, but the financial economy also works in addition, on top of that, as an almost separate biosphere in its own terms, in its own right. So we need to understand the structure of all of this. What's then happened is this. We don't just have two worlds now, we've also got an emerging third digital world and crypto world, which is going to have a massive impact on all of this as well. We have very substantial change in innovation in the area of financial technology, fintech, regulatory technology and regtech, and then pure advanced technology, tech. Fintech, regtech and tech are going to change many of these markets again very substantially over the coming years. What are we looking at? We're looking at the international capital markets, the banking markets, the euro dollar markets, primary money markets, secondary money markets, bonds, notes and paper, structured finance, financial derivatives, insurance markets and commodity markets, including gold. Gold isn't money. Gold is an investment asset. It's part of the commodity market. The bonds, notes and paper, the history of the euro dollar markets is the parallel. It starts with the underlying placement market, the deposit market, the interbank market, with the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958. American banks start to move large dollar deposits into London. We then get very quickly the beginning of the lending market, the loan market, where banks can borrow dollars from each other and lend to governments and companies in the market. That's the early origin of the euro dollar syndicated lending market. Just after that, we then get the beginning of the parallel bond market. You can lend, borrow the same amounts of money for very similar price, for same duration, 20 years for example, very early. The first major international bond was the Otto Strade deal, which was S.U. Warburg, 1963, to raise funds to pay for the construction of all the motorway system in North Italy after the Second World War. That was the first international bond, 63. What then happens is this. These markets develop together as part of the euro-dollar market system. The euro-dollar market, the underlying placement market, the deposit market, the interbank market, and then the two separate syndicated lending market and the bond market. These grow together. But what happens over time is that the capital markets, the bond market, becomes shorter in duration. So rather than issuing bonds for long, 20 years, even 30, 40, up to 50 years, what happens is the bonds get shorter. So we go down from long bonds, 20 year plus, to what we call medium term notes. 15 years, 10 years, maybe down to 5. We then get what we call euro notes. 10, 5, down to 1. Anything less than 1 year we call commercial paper. If it's only up to 1 year, it's commercial paper. If it's between 1 and 20, we'll call it a bond. We call it a note, and then 20 plus, we call it a bond. Now, strictly, legally, the definition is this. If it's fixed interest, it's a bond. So you can't have short 1 year bonds if it's fixed. If it's floating, it's a note. So anything that's floating strictly is a note, anything that's fixed strictly is a bond. But in practice, we tend to talk about it in terms of duration. It's paper up to 1 year, it's a note between 1 and 20, 20 year plus it's a bond. And all of this is explained in further detail in the historical paper and then the market structure paper that you've got on the system. So these are the key international finance markets. What we then have is this. Within that, we've got coinage and banknotes. Banknotes and accounts, equity trading, global stock markets, we can actually begin to give these prices. So all of the banknotes and coinage in the world, what does it add up to? $4.687 trillion. But what are all the bank accounts added up? Almost 100 trillion. So what does that mean? Most of the money in the world isn't money. Money in the form of banknotes and cash, coins, only represents around 4% of all the money in the world. Most of the money isn't money. Most of the money are simply bank accounts. And now legally, what is the bank account? Is a bank account money? Well, no. All a bank account is a claim for a transfer of value by the account holder against the bank. So economists call it money, but it's not money. Not legally. So most of the money in the world isn't money. That's one of the most important things you have to know, you have to learn. And again, what's in a bank account? Nothing. Zero. All a bank account represents is a claim by the account holder to the bank. And we have case law on this. R versus Priddy. Can you steal the money in a bank account? No, because there's nothing to steal. That went all the way up to the House of Lords. R versus Priddy, P-R-E-D-D-Y. It's in the papers. You cannot steal a bank account because there's nothing in it to steal. It just is a claim for value by the account holder against the bank. There's some other interesting case law, for example, Libyan foreign assets. In that case, if the customer is entitled to a very large amount of money, let's say $100 million, can the customer insist on payment in cash rather than just transfer to another bank account? And the commercial court in London decided, Staunton, it could. Customer can claim for full payment in cash if it wants to. The bank does not have a right to only make transfer for large values in account transfers. Total value of the bond markets, $128 trillion, securitization, $1.6 trillion. That's collapsed a lot since the global financial crisis. Financial derivatives are in excess of over $600 trillion. How can the derivatives market be so large? Because that's the nominal value. We calculate all of the transactions against which we make all the payments in the derivatives markets are calculated against larger amounts. That's the nominal amount of the market. So the total nominal amount is well over $600 trillion. That's an enormous amount of money. If you actually work out the amount at risk, it's only $15.8 trillion. It's about 5-6% of the total size. And then by using two very clever devices, netting, through clever, well-drafted legal documentation, if we net provisions, we can reduce the total amount of risk from $600 trillion to $3.4 trillion. That's what clever, well-drafted legal documentation does in the financial area. So these markets can have a nominal value of this, but the amount at risk is only that, $3.4 trillion. And that's astonishing. Insurance markets, $5.5 trillion each year. Shipping markets are worth $14 trillion. Gold markets are around $11.12 trillion. Silver is around $5 trillion. It's very interesting just to understand these markets and see how these grow and change. What's the value of the world as a whole? All the assets in the world, all added up, $431 trillion as of 2020. By 2025, that's expected to grow to $5.45 trillion. That's half a quadrillion dollars. We live in a very rich world. It's just, can we use that intelligently and in a properly distributed, fair, equitable manner? That 431 trillion is made up of 250 financial assets, 235 trillion in real assets, there's 53 trillion liabilities. Again, those figures will rise to 315 financial, 296 real assets, that's the concluded land and property of various forms, 67 trillion liabilities. If we then net out the total amount of debt, what's the debt in the world worth? The total value of GDP, gross domestic product, is $844 trillion per year. Astonishing. But debt levels, 2,198 trillion. 2010, 224, 2020, 67, up to 281 trillion. I've seen different figures. If we deduct that from the previous slide, we get anything between $150 trillion, if it's the high figure, and if it's the low figure, anything up to about $350 trillion. That's the net worth of the world. Astonishing amounts of money. It's just, can we use it? Can we apply it intelligently going forward? financial crisis, areas of risk, possible future trigger events. Historic high debt levels, inflation and interest rates, with the coronavirus cost, the climate cost, technology crisis costs, complex causation and emergence, exogenous and possible existential threat. Most risk is endogenous inside the market, but we have these larger external threats, such as biological threats, climate threats, technology crisis threats, collapse of the internet, things like this. These are exogenous and potentially existential. Existential means we do not recover. We can have catastrophic exogenous events that we can recover from, but if we have existential threats, we're not coming back. This is an existential period. They call it the sixth extinction event. Man, the Anthropocene, the anthropogenic era, which is us for the last 200 years, we have created the sixth extinction event. We could go like the dinosaurs and go quite quickly if we're not careful. Just in China alone, some of the crisis there. Evergrande, $310 billion, astonishing. China real estate market is worth $52 to $55 trillion. The American real estate market is only worth, before the global financial crisis, around $13, $14, $15 trillion. But US commercial real estate is expected to collapse by up to 70%. And then we have massive increases in UK, EU, and global gas and electricity costs. All the problems created by the geopolitical instability, mainly arising as a result of the events in Ukraine. This slide is very useful because it summarizes all the key markets in the world. This is what you need to know, in particular, if you're a wealth manager, an asset manager, or an investor. What are all the main markets in the world we would look at? The American S&P 500, the Dow Jones, the Nasdaq, the electronic market in America. We look at the UK FT 100 or 500, that means the top 100 companies, or the 500 is the top 500 companies. Hang Seng Index, the Shanghai Composite. These are the main stock markets we watch to see where the values are, where they're moving, where they're changing. We also have to watch the bond market. So the US bond market was 1.47%, German 10-year bond was 0.23%. Japan has almost 0% borrowing costs. Japan can almost borrow virtually nothing, regardless amongst the safest bond prices in the world. UK 10 was only 1% about a year and a half ago. But we're now going to come on and see how these have changed. Dollar sterling was at 0.74. The sterling dollar is called the cable rate. Dollar sterling is one figure. Sterling dollar is a completely different figure. Sterling dollar is now today up to 1.24. That's enormous. Sterling's come up very substantially in the last 3 months. It was actually way down at 1.13 at one point, just after the events of last summer. And in particular, the emergency budget that the new Conservative government under new Prime Minister Liz Truss announced in September. It was a mini budget of a form, and markets collapsed after that because it hadn't been properly costed. So we can see the damaging effects of that. But before that, the UK 10-year bond was only 1%, astonishingly cheap. The VIX is an index of instability in the markets. If this is low, perceived instability is low. If this is high, markets are expecting a lot of further losses to come. Oil Brent, we can see the price of oil. It was as low as 1978, around a year and a half ago, but now we'll see the price in a couple of minutes. Dollar was at 173, silver was at 727 per kilo. Last year, we can see how these begin to change. A lot of them, not by that much, but what's much more important is within the last 3 months, 4 months, these are the changes. So we can begin to see what's happening. So a lot of the main stock markets have been down very substantially in value. And what then happens, this is called correlation. At the same time, all the bond prices go up very substantially. So look at the UK 10-year bond. One night it was one, then it was 198, now it's up to over 4. It's back down again, now it's recovered to about 350. But we can see these very substantial, very significant changes. The US 10-year, it was way up to 4.21 as well. It's down again about 3.4, roughly the same as Britain. But Japan was almost zero, it went up to 0.189, it's now about 1.25. German, was very slow, 0.23, 1.98, it went up to 2.258. Just now, France can borrow cheaper than Germany can in the international financial system. You can see the prices of the main exchange rate markets, see where everything's working, everything's moving. Dollar went up very substantially to almost $100, it was at 92 at one point and higher, but it's now collapsed quite a lot. And then again, we can see gold and silver stabilise as well over time. We can see how the international financial system is changing and moving just looking at these figures. What we can also do is this, we can summarise a lot of the key changes in the post-war period with this slide. So post-war market development, massive changes in cross-border market expansion, mainly led by the banks. In the 60s and 70s, it was all banks. The securities markets didn't even have good enough telephones because they were still using old analog systems in the 70s. It wasn't till the mid-80s, late-80s, that the securities markets could even begin to think about this. And it was all controlled by technology. And then the insurance markets again. So cross-border expansion, computer hardware and software developments, massive improvements in telecommunications, the beginning of complex group construction. This again was led by the banks. The banks start to buy out all the other banks, they're merging and taking over each other, so we get large banking groups. But then they start taking over the securities firms and then the insurance companies. So we get what we call financial conglomerates, Bank Assurance groups and Bank Affiance groups in German. Bank Assurance in French, Bank Affiance in German. And then legal deregulation. From the late 1970s, 1980s onwards, there's been a lot of deregulation at the international level, which has supported the international development of globalisation, capital mobility, capital movements, all of which have benefited everyone across the world in the last 40, 50 years until the last 1 year, mainly through the geopolitical instability created in Russia and Ukraine. Financial market effects, we can summarise all of this in terms of market consolidation, market concentration, market innovation, market integration, market aggregation. What were the key market changes in the core decades? 1970s, beginning of the securitisation markets, disintermediation of funds, financial innovation and repackaging in the 80s, then into the 90s, privatisation of markets, 1990s, 2000, deconstruction of risk, 2000 onwards. This is all to do with all sectors of the market developing increasingly sophisticated risk measurement, risk identification, and risk management systems. A lot of people criticise the big banks for creating structured finance, securitisation, and basically forcing on the rest of the market. That's completely wrong. That's not what happened. What had happened was the investment managers, the securities companies, the investment funds, the hedge funds, the wealth managers, they all developed very sophisticated new investment management programs and investment management strategies, and they said, we want highly sophisticated products, and we want products with lots of different grades of risk and risk differentiation. That's what our models need. That's what we want to buy. That's what you have to make for us. It wasn't the banks were creating things that nobody wanted to buy. The market demand side needed this, required this, and asked for this. The banks only provided the service that the rest of the market needed. Post-crisis development, market contraction and restructuring, this is since 2010, 2011, 2012. Market competition and profitability, quantitative easing and quantitative tightening. What essentially happened was this. We created a massive global wall of liquidity by summer 2005 that collapses 2008, 2009, 2010, through quantitative easing, QE, all the central banks in the world reinflate all of this by pumping in massive amounts of money that they've just created in the form of debt. We then moved into quantitative tightening, and since the geopolitical instability that we've now created, we're going through this continued process now of QT, quantitative tightening. So, massive global wall of liquidity, privately created. That collapsed with the global financial crisis. That was then reinflated, recreated with quantitative easing by the central banks for 10 years, 12 years, and now we're tightening, trying to go back, find a new normal since then through QT. And then also market criticism and overregulation. My own opinion is that we had to make a number of changes after the global financial crisis, but we've gone too far in many respects. So we're now over-regulating, making markets unnecessarily inefficient. market reaction and now deregulation, but again with the global geopolitical risks, we're seeing continued deregulation, but we'll also get specific areas of re-regulation again. Overall market innovation, growth and evolution. And all I've tried to do in this next slide is just summarize some of the key costs of some of the major events that we saw. The global financial crisis, Bear Stearns, Lehman, the UK total loss was about $1.16 trillion. The total global impact of the global financial crisis estimated between 12, 14 and $16 trillion. The total global cost of the coronavirus crisis, again, possibly $16 trillion. And I've just included some of the key points of detail in here. It's also in my papers and the other materials I've provided. The global climate crisis, what could it cost us? Minimum $650 billion. Estimates going forward, $7.9 trillion. Total costs, anything between $300 billion and $50 trillion. That's what we're looking at to manage the climate crisis going forward. But what's left? Other potential exogenous and contingent threats and events, biological pandemics, new variants, natural planetary events, earthquakes, tsunamis, solar flares, what they call tipping, magnetic poles, moving. It's actually moving. It's moved over towards Siberia and Russia. This could actually, of itself, cause more climate damage than all the climate costs of the CO2. But people ignore these other larger material planetary effects. Climate impacts, infrastructure failure, technological failure, and geopolitical risk, peace and security. I summarize all of this in terms of SMARTS, STARTS, CHARTS, as well as SCARTS, HERTS. Smarts, starts, charts, hearts, scarts. All of this is built up in the papers that I've provided. We need to build a new future. We have a new opportunity. We have a new responsibility. We have one world. We have one chance. We have one life. We have one future.